This is Equestrian Legacy Radio.
Gotta give them hay, gotta go feed the horses because it's a brand new day. Gotta go feed the horses, gotta feed them now. Gotta go feed the horses because horses need the chow. No time for coffee, can't take time for me. Gotta take care of the animals, so many mouths to feed. Gotta go feed, got to go feed. Chicken. Gotta gather eggs, gotta go give them crack corn so they don't refuse to lay. Gotta go to the hen house before the morning's through. I can hear that rooster singing cock-a-doodle-doo. Procrastination, get out of that bed. Each and every morning, everybody must be fed. Gotta go feed, got to go feed.
Equestrian Legacy Radio, and I'm your host, Gary Holt. We have a great show to end the month of January where cowgirls rule. We have on our show today Pauline Reese, one of music's brightest rising stars, and Lisa Wood, author and long rider. And when we come back on Equestrian Legacy Radio, we'll be visiting with Pauline Reese.
There's a great American hero we all look up to. When the times are hard and chips are down, he knows just what to do. Now a cowboy's got a set of rules that he lives by day to day. If you ask for his advice, he'll more than likely say, if it's a fence, mend it. If it's a dollar bill, spend it, or it burns a hole down in them jeans. If it's a load, truck it. If it's a punch, duck it. If she's a lady, treat her like a queen. That's cowboy logic, every cowboy's got it. It's in the way he lives his life. That's cowboy logic, every cowboy's got it. He's got a simple solution, just about anything. If it's a job, do it. put your back into it. Cause a little bit of dirt's gonna wash off them drains. If it's a horse, ride it. If it hurts, hide it. Dust yourself off, get back on again. That's cowboy logic. Every cowboy's got it. It's in the way he lives his life and the songs he sings. That's cowboy logic. Every cowboy's got it. He's got a simple solution for just about anything. An old cowboy and a young buckaroo were working, riding fence. The old hand was testing the kid on his skills and his common sense. He said, son, if you've seen three men in a pickup, dressed alike from boots to hat, could you tell which one was the real cowboy just from where he sat? Well, the kid scratched his head a while and then he said, well, there just ain't no way to know. The old hand grinned and then he said, kid, you still got a ways to go. The real cowboy's the one in the middle. He ain't there just by fate. Cause first, he don't have to drive. And then, he don't have to mess with the gate. That's cowboy logic. Every cowboy's got it. It's in the way he lives his life and the songs he sings. That's cowboy logic. Every cowboy's got it. He's got a simple solution for just about anything. He's got a simple solution for just about anything.
Michael Martin Murphy's Cowboy Logic. And we have a real cowgirl on the show with us this morning. We're so happy to have Pauline Reese joining us. And Pauline, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great. Doing really well.
Well, that is terrific. How's the weather out in Texas today? It's been kind of icy, I think, hasn't it?
Well, that depends on what day we're talking about. See, today it's cold, breezy, and it's probably around 60 or so. Yesterday we were in the late 30s, early 40s there, and had quite a bit of ice. So, yeah, and tomorrow it's supposed to be 75. So welcome to Texas.
Wow, wow. Well, welcome to Tennessee. I think we were at 20 this morning when I looked. So,
were there actual seasons?
Were there actual seasons, that's right. But we were 60 last Sunday, and then it dropped down and was in the teens this week for the high. So our weather is interesting whether we're in Tennessee or Texas.
Right, yeah, we were wearing shorts and riding horses about 3 days ago.
Oh, gosh. Hey, well, tell us a little bit, Pauline, about your background with horses, because I know you're a real cowgirl. You're in a cowboy family. I think you have a trick horse. There's just a lot for us to talk about today in addition to your music, but how'd you get started with horses?
Well, I've always been passionate about horses and rodeo because my grandfather rodeoed, and just hearing all the stories, and he had a tattoo on his left arm of a horse head with a horseshoe, and it said good luck, so that when he would ride, he rode left-handed. He could see that and, you know, calm down a little bit before he rode. But he rode saddle bronc in the 1930s. So all the stories of – what's that?
No, I just said that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I actually had some friends of mine, Monty Hawkeye Henson, who is a world champion saddle bronc rider, look up my grandfather's career and try to find some stuff. And he said, Pauline, I think he rode before the Turtle Association. And the Turtle Association is what the PRCA is now.
Okay.
And so it's just, it's really cool to hear all the stories, and I actually have pictures of my grandfather. And I've just always been fascinated with cowboys. My heroes have always been cowboys and cowgirls. you know, that's how I came to know Michael Martin Murphy. But I've raised horses. I broke my first horse when I was 10 years old. and my neighbors were all rodeo queens, and so they were about 5 or 6 years older than me, and they lived right across the street. So, you know, as a little girl, they were my heroes, and so I got to rodeo with them, and that's how I started getting into barrel racing, and I did a lot of play days over in East Texas.
Now, did you grow up in Texas? Is that where your family's from?
Yes, sir. I am a seventh-generation Texan and was raised to be proud of where you're from and raised on a little small farm in Pittsburgh, Texas. We raised our own food. We had chickens. We had horses. We had all kinds of animals. We raised pigs, and you name it, we did it. And it was a really wonderful, unique way to grow up in this day and time for a person of my young age. A lot of my friends don't even know how to feed a chicken.
Oh, gosh. Well, I've fed a few chickens, but not necessarily because we were raising them at the farm. I remember when I was growing up, my parents rented the front part of a house from a lady, and she raised chickens in the back. And so on Sunday, we always had really fresh chicken for Sunday dinner.
We did too. My mom had 8 children, and so she didn't, spend the time to cull one chicken at a time. We literally culled them once a year and then froze all of our chickens. So probably not as fresh as getting one out of the flock, but but they were homegrown.
Well, so you did some rodeo growing up. Do you still do a little rodeo?
No, sir. I learned how to rope in high school and did some team roping just for fun. Mm-hmm. And my husband, Bill Herbert, is a phenomenal roper, and I've learned a lot from him. But I do not have time.
I understand.
With my music career. There's no possible way. But so it's more of a leisure thing for me now to ride, and I spend more time teaching my horse tricks than worrying about rodeo. Useful things like tricks.
Well, talk to us a little bit about your horse and your horse tricks. Is that Blue Diamond?
Yes. She's the Blue Roan, which I sent you some pictures. There might be there are some on my Instagram and my Twitter account.
Okay.
So if people want to check that out, they can go there.
I saw pictures of Blue Diamond, and I think I saw more saddles in a tack room than I've ever seen in one place. And rodeo buggies.
Yes. My husband's family rodeos. My father-in-law was a bareback rider. He rode bulls as well. And my mother-in-law, I've got several mother-in-laws, rodeoed, barrel raced, and then my real mother, I have an adopted mother-in-law that I've adopted, and then my mother-in-law now was a world champion calf roper.
Wow.
And Tammy Noble. And so between Bill and his parents, there's quite a few buckles and saddles, and it's something that I've always wanted. I've won plenty of trophies and ribbons from competing, but I've never won a buckle because I was so young when I quit, actually, you know, performance rodeo.
Right.
And so when I won Entertainer of the Year in 2012, my father-in-law and my husband had a buckle made that said Texas Entertainer of the Year 2012.
Oh, wow.
So that's special for me.
Yeah, that really is. That really is. Well, so you when did you start your music, Pauline? Was that something you were always interested in, or
how did that come about? I had trouble deciding whether or not I was going to rodeo or sing. And from a very small age, I just knew I'd always thought I could do both, and then I got older and realized that that's pretty much impossible at this time in my life. But I had my own radio show when I was 5 or 6 years old, and I still have the tapes. I had a radio show called KWXYZ. It's very creative, I think. Always had a sense of humor. And I would try to convince my brothers and sisters to come be on my show.
Yeah. Yeah, and how did you do with that?
Pretty good. I also had an AM station, and I would use my sister's cheerleading megaphone for that station to give it full effect. But I had a music box that was a Grammy, a little gramophone, and I used to practice my Grammy speech. So I always knew this is what I wanted to do. I've always pursued it. I've never, you know, worked somewhere that was not related to music.
Okay.
I've worked in radio quite a bit. I've worked at Western wear stores where I could meet more country people and just be connected to the people that I was singing to. I've always focused on what it was that I wanted to accomplish. So that I've just always known. And, you know, I hear a lot of people on these reality shows who work jobs and they say, oh, I've always wanted to be a singer, but they're not pursuing it. And if you have that deep passion inside of you, like people who rodeo, then you just do it. There's no question about anything. You just do it, and God kind of puts the pieces into the puzzle for you if you truly have faith and have that passion. And it's what you're supposed to be doing. Then I think things fall into place.
Well, that's true. That is true. And you know, being a performer and a successful entertainer is really hard work. And we've talked about this with some folks before. You know, a lot of times you see people that become what are called overnight celebrities and stars.
Mm-hmm.
But but for most of those people, it's not been overnight. It's taken a lot of work to get to where they're going.
No, I've said since I was a kid, I'll be a 20-year overnight success.
goodness. Well, when did you start your career as a professional? When did you really get focused on that?
Well, my parents, just by chance, moved to Austin, Texas when I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I started taking guitar lessons at a store there in Austin and met a lot of people in the business. And when I was 15, the owner of the store heard me taking voice lessons from the teacher there at the store, at the shop. And he said, well, you can really sing. Have you ever thought about pursuing it? I said, that's why I'm taking lessons. That's why I'm here working in your store. And so he said, well, I would love for you to come to a rehearsal and meet the guys in our band. And the band was already touring Texas and Oklahoma, New Mexico some, and even parts of Mexico, actually, a lot of border town stuff. And they were opening shows for Chris LeDoux and Michael Martin Murphy and Johnny Lee and Johnny Rodriguez and people of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to audition. Turns out I had known the guitar player since I was five. He was one of my older sister's best friends. And then when I was 16, I met Willie Nelson through another friend that I had made at the time. And I met Freddie Powers. Then I met Merle Haggard. And, you know, once you do that, I always say I was going to go to college, and then I met Willie. It's not my fault. It could happen to anybody.
that's so funny. That's so funny. Well, that would be a life-changing experience, I'm pretty sure. We want to listen to one of your songs called Just Getting Started. And when we come back, let's talk some more about what's going on with your music career right now. And I may even tell you a few things that Michael Martin Murphy told me about you. But all good. It was all good. But we're talking with Pauline Reese. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio. And this is Pauline's Just Getting Started.
I am full of surprises. I am full of mistakes. Everything I've learned, I learned it the hard way.
getting started, you're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we're talking with Pauline Rees. And Pauline, was that you?
No, it wasn't. You want to explain why? Or should I?
No, you're going to have to explain that one.
Okay. So my computer, when I was out on tour with Michael Martin Murphy, crashed, completely white screen. And even his brilliant Mac-savvy son could not get my computer to work. So I got my older Mac, which I hadn't used in a long time, and just assumed that the songs were off of my album on my MP3s on my iTunes, and they were not. And that's what I had sent to Gary. But, you know, this is why I need my reality show, because – if you could just follow me for one day, I think it's a fascinating journey. It's a lot of women, you know, have day jobs and have children. But for me to be in the entertainment industry, trying to write a cookbook, my husband rodeos professionally, we have two children, we have two ranches, and life gets a little hectic at times.
There's a friend of mine, Templeton Thompson, that's done a song called Life on Planet Cowgirl, and mm-hmm. that just might fit you.
Might
you
fit
know.
Me perfectly. it's certainly fascinating, you know, and I have a really good sense of humor. That's what gets me through life.
Well, we all need some of that. So, but just so that our audience knows, we're going to have you back on the show and play a lot of your music, because we did have some problems getting your songs, and we certainly want to introduce people to your music, and so we look forward to having you come back again. But, you know, we were talking before we listened to the impersonator there, and that really wasn't an impersonator, but before
that
we listened to that,
that
song.
That was a sample song that was sent to me that made me decide to cut that song. And
okay.
I write 95% of my music, but the producer, co-producer of my album, Justin Pollard, thought that that song would fit where I was, because that was off of my sixth album, and I ironically named it Just Getting Started, because, you know, we all go through things in life, changes in life, and you have to learn from those changes, and that's what that song is about. And So I just couldn't resist. It was a great song, and I really liked her version of it. So my version's very similar. You can find it on iTunes. Two of my albums are on there currently, and the rest of my albums are on my website.
Okay. All right. What is your website?
It's all under Pauline Rees. So PaulineRees.com. All six albums are on there.
Okay.
And then Twitter, Instagram, all of those social media networks, Facebook, it's all Pauline Rees.
Okay. All right. So go to PaulineRees.com and check out her albums and buy her music on iTunes as well. And so, Pauline, what was your first gig? I mean, you know, when did you first start performing?
Well, I remember my first show because I couldn't drive to get there. I didn't have a license yet. I was only 15.
Oh, my.
And so my mother had to drive me in her minivan to the band leader's house, and I hopped in the truck with the trailer with the whole band. And the first show I ever played was in Yulin, Texas, at a place called Club 21.
Okay.
And from there, I just played pretty much every honky-tonk in Texas in dance hall, a lot of dance halls. And the difference in a songwriting room and a dance hall is you must sell beer, you must make people dance, so therefore you must become an entertainer, not just a songwriter.
Right.
And so that's where I've been for a really long time. And then once I started writing songs with people like Freddie Powers and Sonny Throckmorton and Ray Wiley Hubbard and people like that, I learned how to focus on my songwriting more, which is another thing Michael Martin Murphy has really helped me excel in.
And well, since you mentioned Michael Martin Murphy, how did you connect with Michael, and how did the because you just came off tour with him. He did his 20th anniversary of the Cowboy Christmas tour. So how did that come about?
Well, I thought I was dreaming, and somebody had to pinch me and tell me that I was on tour with the band, especially opposite Pat Flynn. That kind of blew my mind a little bit. But I had been opening shows for a while throughout the years randomly for Michael, mm-hmm. and he was never there early to catch my performance. He usually had a meet and greet and things of that nature, so he was, you know, preoccupied with his career, of course, and
right.
getting ready for his show. So he never saw me. We always, hi, nice to meet you, I'm honored to meet you kind of thing, and that was pretty much our whole conversation. And then one particular show, he happened to show up early, and he saw me perform, and we kind of got to know each other better. I got to meet his two daughters. I met his wife, Karen, his son, Ryan, and I have become good friends, and they just kind of took me in to their family, and I am so grateful for that because I've been able to get to know him and who he really is as a person, a father, a husband, a friend, a songwriter, a poet. The man just has no boundaries, and that's how I want to be, so he's really been an inspiration for me. And I asked him when we were up in Steamboat, he and his wife Karen and Gary P. Nunn, we were all sitting and having a conversation. And I said, why me? I said, you have all of these singer-songwriters, female singers who are phenomenal, wonderful songwriters, guitar players. Why did you pick me to go on this tour? And he said, because you don't sing for yourself. You don't write for yourself. You sing and perform for the people, for the fans.
Wow. Wow.
You're an entertainer, and that's why. And so that means so much to me. It just can't even tell you as an independent artist how much that truly means.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what Murph told me about you. And we were talking about the folks that were on the tour with him, and a little bit about how he selected them. And when he was talking about you, he said, Pauline is a great-looking gal. She has a tremendous voice, and she is a musician. And so he said, this young lady just has it all. And so I know he was excited to have you on tour with him. You also were on the Red River Drifter CD that he just did not too long ago, and Ryan produced that as well. You did a song on there. I think you sang this with him, and it's a song called Shake It Off.
Yes, yes.
And yeah.
I have to brag for him because he doesn't, you know, I mean, if his publicist says something, then of course he'll back it up. But this song right here has been in the top 10 for almost 19 weeks on the Billboard Bluegrass chart. And so I was giving him a hard time and saying, well, it's because you're riding my coattails, Murph.
Oh, goodness. Well, listen, we want to listen to Shake It Off, and when we come back, we'll talk just a little bit more with Pauline Reese. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio.
Won't shake it off. Hey there, brother. Hey ain't listening, but he won't shake it off.
Shake It Off from the CD Red River Drifter. And Pauline, that's just kind of a fun song.
Isn't it great? You can't help but sing along and dance. I mean, every show, people were up out of their seats dancing. It's great. Love
well,
that
it's, song. It's a fun song, and the CD is a great CD. But let's talk about what you've got coming up. You have a new album that's in the works?
I sure do. I spent last July in Red River, New Mexico, which is where Michael has this new amphitheater,
right.
Which is really phenomenal. I think they're going to go back and do more concerts this summer, so look for that. But I was there with Michael performing at the Motherlode and Texas Reds in the amphitheater, and his son Ryan was in town. Because he was out on tour with Michael. And
So
we all wrote for a solid 2 weeks in between performances. And I was just so thrilled with the outcome. So I decided that the songs were just too good to not put out there and produce a seventh album. So I've got Justin Pollard with the Pat Green Band back co-producing with me on this seventh album, and the first single is a song that Michael and I wrote called Trail of Tears, and I'm going to get Willie Nelson on there as a duet.
Wow.
Yeah. I had actually sent Willie the idea when I first had it in the works, and he said, I like the concept. And so then I never heard back, so I went ahead and finished it with Michael. And then I sent it to him, and he, I mean, I've been in touch with Willie, and I talk to him every so often, but it's usually an email or a text, funny joke.
Right.
I don't really spend a lot of time hanging out with Willie, per se. He's on the road.
Right.
But he literally emailed, called, and texted for a solid 2 weeks about that song. And so then we finally discussed it, and he said, I want you to go cut it how you think it would be a hit, and I'm going to come in and put my parts on it and my guitar. And so that's where we're at. I just finished it yesterday, and now we've got to go into the mixing phase.
Well, that is terrific. So when can we look for that to be released and ready to listen to?
Hopefully within a month. That's my plan.
That is great. Well, now you know what that leads me to do, and that means I've got to ask you to come back when that thing's released so that we can get that out to our audience.
Absolutely. You bet. You bet.
All right.
I'm so excited about it. I can't wait for all of my fans to hear it, and hopefully we'll make a few more fans.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, we're looking forward to doing that. We're looking forward to having you back on the show and really playing a lot of your music so we can introduce folks to that. And again, let's tell people about your website, and that's PaulineReese.com.
Yes, PaulineReese.com.
Okay, and you've got a couple of pages on Facebook that people can visit you at and kind of keep up with where you are, and that's Pauline Reese on Facebook. You also, how do we find you on Twitter?
Well, my Twitter is at Pauline Reese.
Okay.
And my Instagram, if you want to see my horse and kind of keep up with my life and kind of what's going on. Then you can find me on Instagram as well at Pauline Reese.
All right.
And I'm currently starting a blog, and it might be a video blog. We're not sure yet. I've been working with a media group. So I will let you know from my website.
All right. Well, we'll keep up with you on that, and we look forward to following you. And we really are looking forward to hearing the new album when it comes out. And Pauline, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I know that you've got a hectic schedule with all that's going on in your life, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much for having me, and honored to be on a show with other horse lovers, rodeo, and music people. Thank you so much, Gary.
Well, thank you. Look forward to having you back, and we're going to listen to Mountain Storm from the Red River Drifter album. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Lisa Wood. Thanks a lot, Pauline. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Oh, won't you wait a little sky and a waning moon. Next thing you know, the sun will shine. See a double rainbow through the pines. Oh, won't you wait a little while before you cry?
Michael Martin Murphy's Mountain Storm. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we have a young lady that's joining us on the program now that I am really looking forward to talking with. We got to visit a little bit a couple of nights ago and talk about her life. Lisa Wood, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Gary, and thank you especially for calling me a young lady.
Well, you are. You are.
All righty. All right. It's all relative.
I find that's the truth as I get older myself. So anyway, you know, we've talked about the fact is we're promoting the show that you're an author and you're a long rider, and we want to talk about all of that, the long rider part. For our listeners that may not be familiar with what a long rider is, what is that?
All righty. Well, there's an organization called the Long Riders Guild, and they've kind of set up the framework that I go by, and that is to qualify as a long rider, you have to ride 1,000 miles or more without support. And so I've done two rides that qualify as long rides. The first one was up the west coast of California, and the second one from the Santa Monica Mountains to Oregon, and the second one was from San Diego to Virginia. So that one,
wow,
was the first one was about 1,500 miles, and the second one was about 3,000 miles, and those were solo unsupported trips.
Wow, and we're going to get into those a little bit more, but tell us a little bit about your background and how and when you got started with horses.
Well, Pauline said she started riding when she was 10. I think I've got her beat by a few years. I started riding when I was 3, kind of by accident. My mother was a Girl Scout leader, and I had an older sister who was in the Girl Scouts. We were living in Bakersfield, California, which has an unusual disease that people often get, especially when the wind blows. It's out of the dirt. It's called Valley Fever, and my mother got that.
Wow.
And she couldn't go out with the Girl Scouts to take them on this horseback ride they were supposed to go on. So my father said, well, I'll take the girls out there. I don't want to disappoint them. But he couldn't leave me home with my sick mother. So my dad took me out there, and apparently, I don't remember any of this, but apparently they put me on probably some big old gentle horse. But the way my dad tells the story, they didn't send a wrangler with them, and my dad was trying to get the girls to kick their horses and get them to leave the stable, and it wasn't going very well. And horses got to milling around, and they got to wanting to go back toward the stable, and apparently the one I was on was the most barn sour of them all, started taking off toward home, and Dad took out after me, afraid I was going to get trampled, and well, then it was just a mad stampede back to the stable, and Dad came rushing up and swooped me out of the saddle, and apparently I said, Daddy, my horsey, go. So it was fate from there. I had my first ride when I was 3, and there was no looking back.
Oh, that's great. That is great. Well, you know, and I find that there are two situations with folks with horses. They either start when they're very young, or it's something that they've had a dream about doing, and they're maybe in their 40s and sometimes even in their 50s before they get their first horse and get started. So it's pretty cool to be able to start when you're 3 years old and start riding and keep doing that. Let's talk a little bit about what type of riding that you did before you decided to start this first long ride. So what had been your riding background?
Well, I spent a lot of years what they call the horseless rider. There's a woman that wrote a book about it. I really like her book. I found pretty quickly that people needed you to help out with their horses. I worked at a stable when I was a kid. I worked with people's problems horses, started training horses, exercising endurance horses, taking lessons, of course. And there are a lot of advantages to being a horseless rider. You get exposed to a lot of different ways of riding, a lot of different breeds of horses. And I really, for many years, I thought, why would I ever have my own horse when people pay me to ride their horses for them? And it really wasn't until I decided to do this long ride that it became necessary to have my own horse. Now that I have my own horses, I don't ever want to ride other people's horses. I just want to ride mine. So.
I understand. Well, I've got to ask, what possessed you to decide that you wanted to make that first long ride?
Well, I like to blame my parents because my parents were teachers, and we would often go on long car trips with the tent in the trunk of the car when I was a little girl, and I would look out the window kind of bored and imagine myself riding a horse along the countryside. But it's really not my parents' fault. It's the fault of a historical figure. His name is Joseph Smeaton Chase, and in 1911, Mr. Chase, who lived in El Monte, California, that's in the eastern part of L.A., he decided that he wanted to travel up the coast of California and just kind of check it out. And he did that. In fact, he did three major trips through California. He did a desert trip, a Yosemite trip, and the California coastal trip. And I now have first editions of all of his books, but I just happened across his California coastal trails book one time, and he talked about what a beautiful state California is and what a lovely ride it was going up the coast. And I had a dream while I was reading that book. I fell asleep and I dreamt that it was me riding up the coast, and I woke up that next morning and I said, yeah, I'm going to do that. Even if I have to quit my job to do it, I'm going to do that.
Oh, wow.
And I did. And I had never owned a horse before that.
Wow. So talk a little bit about the, you didn't read the book and wake up and have the dream, and after having the dream and then get your horse and start riding, what was the preparation to get ready to do a ride, and what was involved in that?
Well, there was quite a bit of preparation, and of course on that first ride I did not know what I was doing, and I did the best I could, and I got my first horse. And of course, I only had him for about 2 months before I took off. I was originally planning on taking one of my client's horses, but that fell through at the last minute, so it was kind of a little bit of a scramble to get a horse at the last minute. I had to get a truck and a trailer because I had to have some way of getting the horse back once I got to Oregon. I had to research my gear. So there's a man here in San Diego County named Gary McClintock who makes handmade saddles, does a beautiful job, and he's very experienced with packing himself. He's done a lot of mule trips down in Baja. So I got a lot of advice from him, and he referred me to other people that had done a lot of long riding. And I tell you what, most of them were rugged men who were older than I was and more experienced than I was, and most of them just kind of shook their head and told me I was barking up the wrong tree and I was going to kill myself and my horse on this trip. And one of them told me I was going to lose 10 or 20 pounds, and he told me I better start bulking up now, and he recommended I drink a lot of milk and eat a lot of bananas to start fattening up for the trip. And so, you know, I didn't know I started doing that. I was drinking milk and eating bananas and thinking I was going to starve to death on the trail. I didn't starve to death on the trail, but I didn't know how hard it was going to be. But I got advice from wherever I could. I read all the books I could. I studied the maps. I talked to Rain. rangers. Where I could, I made arrangements in advance. For example, one state park, I called them and asked them if I could camp on the state park, and they said, well, you'll need to get a special event permit for that, and you'll need to show us that you've got liability insurance. So I called my homeowner's insurance, and they kind of waffled on that a little bit. So I changed my homeowner's insurance and sent in the forms and got the special event permit so that I could camp on the beach in Oxnard. And you know, so I spent a lot of time worrying, and as it turned out, I didn't have to quit my job. My job gave me an unpaid leave of absence, so that worked out pretty well. And I gave my parents power of attorney over my finances so that they could keep the bills being paid while I was gone. And so I did a few things like that. But I tell you, there's nothing that really prepares you for that first day, and all of a sudden you realize what you've gotten yourself into. I've done this twice now, and both times the first day I'm totally panicked.
Well, let me ask about that horse that you bought. What kind of horse was it, and what kind of preparation did he or she have to have to get ready to do this trip?
Well, like I said, I was planning on taking one of my customers' horses, so it was kind of a last-minute deal when that didn't work out. And I found a couple of horses that looked like they were going to work from a horse trader up in Riverside, and I told her, well, probably one of these horses, but there's just one more horse I want to check out. And he was not listed with any breed. It just said ranch horse up in the town of Julian. So I went up to see this quote-unquote ranch horse, and he was 6 years old, and he just seemed very sensible. And the rancher who was selling him let me take him on a little test drive, and I took him over rocks and through some mud and through some branches, and that horse was the smartest little horse I ever rode, just figuring out exactly how to get through tough areas. And I came back and paid full price for that boy. He was asking $2,000 for him. He was 6 year old, quarter horse appy, no registration on him. And I have never been sorry. That's the best $2,000 I ever spent. That horse took care of me on that ride. He is a smart son of a gun. He is now 28 years old and still going strong.
Wow. Wow. So that first ride was 22 years ago.
It was 22 years ago. Like,
wow.
I say, I'm not exactly a young woman.
Wow. Well, you just started young. You started young. But,
I did start young.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about
I'm sorry, Gary. You just impressed me. That's quick on the math.
Well, I just calculated how old the horse was when you got him and how old he is now. So that was pretty easy math.
All righty.
You and I talked the other night about what you took with you on your trip, because you didn't take a pack horse. It was just you and what was this? What's this horse's name?
His name is Cacho. That's the name he came with. C-A-C-H-O, Cacho.
Okay.
Which means,
right,
if anybody speaks Spanish, it means little. He's my little chunk.
All right. But anyway, just the two of you. So, you know, how did you prepare? What did you take with you to do a 1,300-mile ride?
Yeah, and that is a really important question. A lot of folks, when they call me for advice about long riding, they want to bring more stuff than what they can carry on one horse. The rule of thumb, generally speaking, is you don't want to put more than a fifth of the horse's weight on the horse. It would be the same thing if you were carrying a backpack day after day after day. You don't
right.
want to put more than a fifth of your own weight on your back. You know, for a day or two you can carry more, but you can't do that day in and day out over a few months. So when you're limited to a fifth of your horse's weight, when you got a little horse like Cacho who's about 900 pounds, that, you know, I'm 5'8". So I got a couple of pounds of myself, and obviously you can't have a big old heavy Western saddle on there. A lightweight tent. I had an antique military saddle that I used, a McClellan saddle, same kind of saddle Mr. Chase used in 1911, and that's
right.
a good saddle. Doesn't give any saddle sores, and it's nice and lightweight. You can pack on it. It does not have any padding, and I knew where my hip bones were by the time I got to Oregon.
That's where the milk and the bananas came in.
it didn't provide enough padding to help that situation. So you got your lightweight saddle, your lightweight tent, your lightweight sleeping bag, a 2-quart canteen, and a wallet, and that is just about it. I did kind of make a joke out of it. I was at a campsite in Northern California, and there were some people picnicking there, and they had invited me to join their picnic, which I happily did. And so the father of the family was asking his kids, well, what do you think she had to bring with her? And the kids were pretty smart. They didn't say television set or games or anything like that. But one of them said, well, toothbrush. And I said, yeah, I brought a toothbrush. I said, but, you know, I have to really watch the weight that my horse has to carry, so I didn't even bring dental floss. Well, the father was not happy to hear that. As it turned out, he was a dentist,
He
thought that one should definitely pack dental floss, even if you're keeping it to a bare minimum. So as they were leaving that campsite, he gave me a little pack of dental floss. Well, I told that story to other people, and I tell you what, if I had taken all the dental floss people wanted to give me, I'd have brought back about 10 pounds of dental floss.
Yeah, you could have opened a store or something. But yeah.
I could have opened a dental floss store, but hey, who needs dental floss when you got mane hair right there?
That's right. Well, what about food? I mean, what did you take as far as food, and you know, how did you eat as you were traveling?
Well, I did start off with a couple of dehydrated dinners and some of the kind of fare that, you know, I've done a lot of backpacking, and some of the kind of stuff you bring when you're backpacking, but you really can't bring more than 4 or 5 days worth of food with you at a time. So that's going to run out right away. And what you're going to have access to after that is, well, in my case, on both trips, what I had access to was what you can buy in a gas station. And
okay.
There's plenty of candy bars and beef jerky and that kind of thing that you can buy in a gas station. And I can go 4 days on a granola bar. It'll work.
It's really nice to find people that have a picnic spread out after you've done that too.
Yes,
yeah.
It is. I will tell you that when people invited me to have a meal, and people often do, you know, that is such a meaningful gift when somebody needs food. And believe me, there were times that I needed food, and many times people provided me food. It's like communion, you know. It is just a really, really important gift. People would stop along the road, and they would say, like on a hot day, I had a lady pull over one day, and she said, "Would you like?" This was on the cross country trip. You can tell by the words she used. She said, "Would you like a cold soda?" We don't call them sodas here in California, but they did where she was from. And I said, "Yeah, that'd be great." And she said, "Well, just keep on going. I'll bring you one." And she went off to town or wherever, and she came back and she brought me a cold soda and a bag of candy bars.
Oh, cool. That's cool. And I was going to ask you about it. And well, there are two questions that come to mind as you were talking just then. First of all, what type of ground were you covering? I mean, were you on beaches? Were you on highways? Were you on mountains? I mean, a combination of all of that. What type of riding actually was it to do 1,300 miles on the California coast?
Well, that California coastline is really, really spectacularly beautiful for anybody that's ever had a chance to drive it. You can drive it along Highway 1. Obviously, I avoided the highway as much as I could. There were times that I was along Highway 1, which meant that the terrain that I covered was even more beautiful than what the highway goes through. But the highway, it visits the missions and the lighthouses that are along the California coast up in the northern part of California. There were Russian forts being built about the same time the California missions were being built in Southern California. There's some spectacular tree groves up in Northern California. There's one place called Avenue of the Giants where there are these massive redwood trees, and I had the privilege of being able to ride through what's called now the Avenue of the Giants, just a spectacularly beautiful area. Around the Monterey area, there's a very scenic drive called 17 Mile Drive. People sometimes drive that. There's a golf course and then a rocky coastline. and a lot of deer in that area, and I had the opportunity to ride 17-mile drive. So everything from the low scrubby parts of Southern California up to the magnificent redwoods of Northern California on that California trip. And then, of course, on the cross-country trip, we had quite a bit of desert to cross and some challenges with water going across the desert. And then it was kind of a relief when we got to Kansas, because once we got to Kansas, I knew there'd be grass and water from then on out. And so it was much easier taking care of the horse after that, because that's really what you're looking for when you're long riding, is plenty of places with grass and water. And again, just like the rule of thumb for weight is you don't want the horse carrying about more than about a fifth of his own weight. Same thing when you're on roadside graze, you want your horse grazing at least 6 hours a day, and that needs to be aggressive grazing. They're only going to graze aggressively for about 15, 20 minutes, and then they're going to start just kind of snacking here and there.
Right.
So that means that you're not looking for the place with the good view. You're looking for the place with the good grass.
Right. Got to take care of your partner on this trip on
mm-hmm.
there. Well, you know, the other question that I was going to ask you is the people that you met along the way, because it's pretty interesting. You know, if I were hitchhiking or just walking or hiking, you know, I probably wouldn't have as much might be a different response than you would for somebody that was riding a horse. What was the response that you got from folks and after they found out what you were doing? Because I'm sure, you know, they probably asked and you probably shared what your trip was.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, there was on the cross-country trip, that trip was in 2001. And that trip I did on a Mustang mare that I had just rescued, and I barely had her under saddle when I took her out across the country. And a lot of my friends here in San Diego who have more expensive horses, because I paid $1 for Shawnee. And a lot of my friends thought I overpaid. They described her as mean, stupid, ugly, and untrainable. And so they were a little bit shocked that I was planning to ride her across the country. She's a tricolor pinto. She's got a lot of white on her and also brown and black. And she's Medicine Hat. And I rescued her because I liked her, and she took to the saddle very quickly, although she was a little skittish, especially at the beginning. But I crossed a couple of Indian reservations with her. The first one I crossed was a Pima reservation, and the second one I crossed was an Apache reservation. And, you know, a white girl crossing an Indian reservation might not be so welcome, and I hadn't gotten any permits or notified anybody ahead of time, but I got very lucky because, you know, the horse is a door opener in a lot of circumstances, but in this case, having a Medicine Hat horse on an Indian reservation, I tell you, the Indians loved my horse, and they were very kind to me and very helpful of me, and they told me the legend of the Medicine Hat horse. I don't know if you know that story, Gary.
I don't. Share that with us.
Okay. Well, different Indians told me different bits and pieces of it, but since the Medicine Hat horse has brown on the top of the head and the ears, they think that's like what the shaman wears, and they ascribe magical powers to the Medicine Hat horse. And even just seeing the Medicine Hat horse is a good omen, so they were happy to let me spend the night on their property. And the story goes that the brave that rides the Medicine Hat horse is protected by the Medicine Hat horse and is invulnerable to bullets and arrows. And I will say that this mare is a very sweet and very protective mare, and nobody's ever been hurt riding her. So maybe there is something to that Medicine Hat legend.
Oh, wow. Well, that's pretty interesting. I'll have to watch for the Medicine Hats when I'm out on the trail somewhere and see how many I might see.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, we want to take just a real short break. We're going to listen to a song called Shortgrass by R.W. Hampton, and that kind of is appropriate for somebody that's out on the trails. And when we come back, we're going to talk more, and we'll be just back in a moment after this and talk with Lisa Wood on Equestrian Legacy Radio.
the short grass grows. I'm going where the short grass grows. The blue mountains rise and the wind always blows. A place big enough for a man to dream. Back home where the short grass grows. The Lord never painted a prettier sky, almost as blue as the blue of her eyes. When we shared our love by the piñon fire's glow, back home where the short grass grows. I'm going and the wind always blows. A place big enough for a man to dream. Back home where the short grass grows. Where the ponies run wild like the wind in her hair. When I close my eyes I can almost be there. I can see my love awaiting where that old sweet water flows. Back home where the short grass grows. I'm going where the short grass grows. Blue mountains rise and the wind always blows. A place big enough for a man to dream. Back home where the short grass grows.
The short grass is a waving to a turquoise sky above. The aspen-covered hills guard the country that I love. I'm going where the short grass grows. The blue mountains rise and the wind always blows. A place big enough for a man to dream. Back home where the short grass grows. My home where the short grass grows. The short grass grows.
You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio, and we're talking with Lisa Wood. And Lisa, while we were doing that break, we were talking about a few things that you took with you or didn't take with you, and we won't talk about that. But we won't talk about what we talked about during the break. But I got to ask you, what type of clothing did you take? You told me something kind of interesting about a shirt.
Yeah. So on the first trip, I made a mistake, and that is the first couple of days I didn't wear my gloves, and that is just a big no-no. My knuckles became all cracked and bleeding, and that was a bad idea. So my second trip, I was much better. I wore my gloves every day, long-sleeve cotton shirt, and it had to have two front pockets. And the reason it has to have two front pockets is I carry today's map in one pocket and tomorrow's map in the other pocket. I love looking at my maps as I go along, although I will tell you that the first couple of days out, Kacha was afraid of maps, which kind of tickled me a little bit because he's not afraid of too many things, but those maps kind of made him nervous at the beginning. So a long sleeve cotton shirt, and I did have a rain slicker and a cowboy hat with a brim on it, and felt, of course, because, you know, all kinds of weather, and some good sturdy breeches, and I did carry some extra socks. And the first trip I used heels down athletic shoes, and just going to Oregon, those were completely disintegrated by the time I got there. Because you do, there's an expression in the long riding community, if you ain't getting off and walking, you ain't long riding. Because we get off and walk quite a bit. And those things were shot. So for my cross country trip, I used hiking boots. So that meant, that was my attire. And it was the same shirt day after day after day after day. But on the cross-country trip with 5 miles and a lot of heat going through the desert and hail and all that kind of thing, the shoulders actually kind of rotted out.
Oh,
and
wow.
I got some rags from somebody that had let me spend the night, and I sewed those into the shoulders. So
wow.
I was quite the vagrant-looking person by the time I got to Virginia.
Well, now, you know, we haven't talked about this, but how long did it take you from start to finish on these rides?
Okay, so the West Coast trip, 1,500 miles, Cacho and I averaged 15 miles a day. And like I say, not too much bothers that horse. He's generally pretty calm. And, you know, he was 6 years old then, but he's pretty calm. And it was a little bit of work to get 15 miles a day out of him. There were days we did a few more miles than that, but anything more than that, you had to work pretty hard. His kind of attitude, we'd be out about a mile, and he'd say, here's a good spot of grass. We could camp here. Like, okay, we got to do more than a mile. That's not going to work. Now the Mustang mare that I just put under saddle, she was the opposite. When I rescued her, she had been locked in a little 12 by 12 enclosure for more than 5 years. And
oh, wow.
her feet had fallen apart. You know, they were all soft and splayed out and abscessed. And being Medicine Hat, she's also bald-faced, and she had scabs over her eyes. She came together pretty quickly. As soon as I started riding her and taking her out, her feet hardened up, and she's got those good Mustang feet, and I started putting a fly mask on her. And I didn't use the fly mask too much going across the country. I used sunscreen on her.
Uh-huh.
To keep her from sunburning. But let's see, I lost my track. What was I about to tell you about? Oh, how many? She had a lot more energy than Cacho. She averaged 20 miles a day, and in her case, the issue was getting her to settle down and let's just camp for the night. I would tie her to a fence post or a bush or something and set up my little tent, and she'd say, oh, come on, we could do a few more miles. Let's go.
Yeah, one of the pair needed a break, didn't they?
Yeah, and she also, I had a hard time getting her to walk. You know, in that case, I needed the break. I had a hard time getting her to walk. Long riders, we want to be walking most of the time because if you're trotting or loping, your gear is going to be rubbing saddle sores. And, man, you want to be vigilant for saddle sores at all times. So I kind of had to compromise with her and let her trot the first 15 or 20 minutes to kind of get it out of her system so I wasn't fighting with her. And then we could settle down to a nice brisk walk. Now, she walks out at 4 miles an hour. She still does. She walks out 4 miles an hour. She's got a nice brisk walk on her. But even when Cacho was a young man, he walks out at 3 miles an hour, and there ain't nothing you can do to speed that up.
Oh, gosh. So how long did the California Coast ride take you?
So that took 3.5 months on Cacho, going up the California Coast, and then going across the country, that took 5 months.
Wow. 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 So were there points in the ride when you thought, you know, I'm kind of getting tired of this and, you know, we're ever going to get to the end or?
No, it doesn't go that way for me. Like I say, the first day I'm kind of panicked thinking, you know, what the heck did I just get myself into? And then so the first day I'm panicked and the second day I'm sore. And sore and noticing how stinky I'm becoming and uncomfortable and dirty. But by the time I've been out 4 or 5 days, I start getting into the rhythm of it, and I don't notice the discomfort. You know, people say, well, you're sleeping on the ground. Isn't that uncomfortable? Yeah, I noticed that the first couple of days. But after a while, I don't notice that anymore, and I get into the rhythm of it. And the only thing that is really difficult about it is that anxiety about where to camp every day. That gets old. But the actual having new experiences every day and having the new challenges and figuring out how to get from point A to point B, that and meeting new people and seeing new landscapes, that never gets tired for me. And so when I start, kind of bittersweet, because I'm glad the anxiety of taking care of my horse is about to be over with. It's so much easier to take care of your horse when you're not on the trail. But it's also very sad because it means that, you know, this great adventure is going to be over with. So, yeah, I don't really get tired of the physical challenges. What I get tired of is the anxiety of taking care of the horse on the trail.
Right. Did you have situations where maybe you were in an area where there were folks that said, you know, you can stay here tonight and, you know, take a shower and we'll wash that shirt. You know, you might consider washing the shirt before we give you dinner. Yeah.
I got that a lot. I got that a lot. People were very, very good to me. There was one case up in Northern California where the folks not only did they have a stall for Cacho and hay for Cacho and a bath for me, but they had one of those kind of bathtubs with the jets in it,
yeah.
You know? And the lady, she handed me a cold drink and a bathrobe, and she said, "I'll see you in a half hour." She gave me permission to sit in that bathtub and soak. I thought, oh, man, that was lovely.
Gosh,
that was
gosh.
Lovely.
Oh, my gracious. Well,
You appreciate food when you're on the trail, but you also appreciate a hot bath when you're on the trail.
Oh, I bet. I bet. I bet you do. Did you have any trouble keeping track of time? I mean, you know, there's sometimes when, you know, Monday through Friday, people are at work, and so, you know when the weekend is there, and then it's time to go back, and you kind of track your days that way. Did you ever lose track of the days while you're out on the trail?
I kept a journal, and I hate to admit this because one of my goals initially when I first took off was to not be tied to time and to lose track of time. But honestly, I never did. In fact, I think I made a spiritual mistake, as it were, when I was camped out on the Apache Reservation. This family had let me set up my tent on their property, and they had invited me inside for soup. And they had horses of their own and were very, very good horse people. It was three generations living in the same little compound, and they were very kind to me. And they started talking to me, and they said, you know, we have a powwow here once a year, and we want to invite you to come with our family to the powwow. And the thing is, I had gotten a leave of absence from work, and they made it very clear when they gave me the leave of absence that it was for a limited amount of time, and if I didn't make it back, my job was gone. And,
So
if you can believe my decision, this was toward the beginning of the ride, and I didn't know Shawnee was going to be so much faster than Cacho was. So I chose not to go to that powwow. I moved on the next day. When I headed out the next morning, I could hear the powwow starting. You could hear the music and the dancing and all that. And I look back on that, and I think, what a fool. You didn't stay for the powwow. You're an idiot.
Goodness. Well, what about were there some folks or situations that you encountered that just kind of stick out in your mind? You know, any special people or events that happened that, you know?
Well, so many. So many. Here's one that was particularly important to me. Let's see. It was in a little town called Estancia in New Mexico, and they call that area the High Lonesome there. Not a lot of people there. Beautiful landscape. And I got to this little town, and I was, you know, kind of looking around for a place with grass and water where I could pitch my tent. And there was a young man from the Soil Conservation Service out on the street, and I came riding up to him, and I said, howdy. and you know, people will talk to you when you ride up to them. And usually I swing down so that I'm not looking down on people. I'll get down on their level. So I'll swing down off my horse to talk to people. So I talked with this young man, and I said, you don't happen to know a place where my horse and I could spend the night, do you? And he said, yeah, I know just about the perfect place. He said, see right across the street over there, that feed store? Jim Frost, he'll let you spend the night. And I said, feed store, that sounds perfect. Well, thank you very much. So I went across the street to the feed store, and I knocked on the door, and the gentleman came out, and he's a fabulous horseman. He'd lived in that area for a long time. And he said, sure, you can camp out right here behind this feed store, no problem at all. And as a matter of fact, his home was about 20 miles outside of town, right on my route. So I camped out behind his feed store the first night I met Jim, and then I went to his home the second night and camped out at his house the second night. So he was a very special person. There's a little bit more to this story. I'll go ahead and tell it. My parents are still alive and well. They're in their late 80s, and they really hate it when I do this kind of stuff. They just sit home and worry about me all the time. And my father is a World War II veteran. And when he first went into the service, they gave all the Army boys a test. And if they tested well, they sent him into a program called ASTP, Army Specialized Training Program. And the Army had taken over a college there in New Mexico Socorro, New Mexico. And so he had been in that program for a little while before they shipped him over to the European theater. Well, when his daughter was going to be riding her horse through that area, my parents live here in California, he all of a sudden decided that he had to go back to Socorro, to where he had been all those years ago, right before he went into service in World War II. The excuse was to see Socorro again. You know, it was to make sure I was still doing well. That's exactly. So my parents flew out from California to Albuquerque, and they rented a car. And, you know, I was calling them every few days. Whenever I would have access to a phone, I would call. I didn't have a phone with me, but I would call them if somebody would let me borrow their phone. And so they knew about where I was going to be. So when I knew they were going to fly out, I said, all right, on such and such a day, I will be at the entrance to a wildlife preserve that I knew was right on my route. Well, that meant, you know, people sometimes want to have support when they're long riding. I don't like to have it, because I'll tell you, those few days leading up to that were very stressful, because I know if I hadn't been there where I told my parents I was going to meet them, there'd be helicopters up looking for me.
Right.
So
right.
It meant I couldn't dawdle where I wanted to dawdle. I had to be there. And I was there, and I met my parents. And they stayed there for a couple of days. So the next night, after I met them that first night, they brought hay and water in their car, so I didn't have to worry about finding a camp spot with grass and water. I just had to mark a place on my map, have my parents meet me there, and boom, that would be my campsite. So that worked for a couple of days, but then they were going to be flying home, and I didn't know where I was going to spend the night, so I didn't know if they would see me or not. Well, that's the night I camped in back of Jim Frost's feed store in Estancia.
Okay.
And they didn't, you know, their daughter is now off again, and they're hoping they're going to see her. Well, I had pitched my tent behind his feed store, and they came driving into Estancia. They happened to turn down that little side road, and they saw Shawnee. You know, she got all that white on her. They saw Shawnee, and they got to meet Jim, who was taking good care of me. And it made them feel good before they flew home that now, you know, they kind of handed me off to Jim Frost, the man who owned the feed store. Well, Jim Frost wasn't done taking care of me. Jim Frost told me that he was going to be taking a colt to his daughter in Michigan, and he was going to be following pretty much the route I was going to be taking. So if I needed anything, not to worry about it, he could bring me whatever I needed. Well,
wow.
I didn't know how that was going to work, because, you know, I'm in the middle of nowhere just riding my horse, and Jim doesn't have a cell phone, and I don't have a cell phone. But I did know I was going to have trouble getting across the Mississippi River. I knew that ahead of time, because I had driven my rig across ahead of time. And when you're on the side of a bridge, you need to have a sidewalk, and your sidewalk needs to not be one of those metal things. I tried that with Kacha. When it's just a big sheet of metal, they can't get purchase on it, and they'll slip and slide all over the place.
Right.
And I had not found a bridge across the Mississippi River that I was going to be able to handle. So I was kind of worried about that, and I was getting closer and closer to the Mississippi River, and I was alongside a road, and wouldn't you know, A truck and a horse trailer came right past me, pulled off on the shoulder. He opened up the back. There was one colt in there, and it was one of those straight loads, and one slot open, and he just shoved Shawnee right in there and took me right across the Mississippi River.
Wow.
So that's how I got across the Mississippi River, Jim Frost from Estancia.
That's pretty amazing. Well, now I want to ask you this. Now, when you get to the end of the ride, I mean, you're not doing round trip, right?
Not on these two rides, no.
Yeah, so you get to the end of the ride, then you trailer back home?
Yeah, so for example, on my cross-country trip, my leave of absence started on February 1st of that year, of 2001. And so I drove my rig across the country, and I got to tell you, that was an old piece of junk pickup and an old stock trailer that I was pulling at the time. And camping out in that pickup truck in February was... It was difficult, and I was trying to kind of follow my route, so I was getting stuck in the mud and the snow and every which way and camping in that freezing truck. But I spent the month of February driving my rig across, and then I have a girlfriend that I went to high school with here in California who lives in Virginia now, and I had called her up and told her that I was riding out her direction. Now, I wasn't really intending to end up in Virginia. What I had done for the cross-country trip is I had strung together three historical trails, the Kearney Trail, which goes from San Diego to Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Trail, which goes from Santa Fe to St. Louis, and then the way the Conestoga wagons had gotten there was on the old National Road, which is more or less Highway 40, which would have taken me into Pennsylvania and up in that area, and that's where I planned on finishing up. But I'd called Karen to let her know what I was doing, and she said, well, Lisa, I live in horse country. You ought to end up at my house. And I said, well, Karen, that would be 300 miles out of my way. And she said, yeah. So that's what I did. I drove my rig out to Karen's house, and then I flew home, and then I rode my horse over to Karen's house, and then I drove home. And my parents were both high school teachers, and Karen had been a student of my mother's. So Karen and my mother threw me a big welcome to Virginia party.
Wow.
That we had there at Karen's house. And then my mom flew home because my parents were helping with my sister's kids, so they had grandkid duty. My mom flew home to be with the grandkids. My dad flew out, and my dad drove back with me.
Oh, great.
So
great.
My dad, I called people that could put Shawnee up, that I had met coming out, that could put Shawnee up and that had an actual bed for my dad. I didn't think my dad should be sleeping in the barn. And since all these people knew we were coming on the way back, we just rolled from one party to another. And when we got to Jim Frost's place in Estancia, Jim Frost plays in a little band. Well, he had the whole band over, and the band played, and then they found out that my dad can rip out a good gospel on the piano. We were partying till 2 o'clock in the morning that night, and my poor dad, because every morning we left at 6 or 7 in the morning, no matter how late, we'd stayed up partying the night before.
I guess he got a nap or two in the truck as you were headed back home.
Yes, he did. He's good at that.
Oh, goodness. Hey, we want to take another quick break, and there are just so many things that, so many questions and things that we can talk about on this, but we're going to listen to Under a Rolling Sky, and we're going to come back and talk with Lisa Woods some more. You're listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio.
It's a perfect day to lose our way, watching the world drifting by, living without asking why. What will be, it's a mystery. Is blue, I wish I knew. There is no need to explain, it'll all wash away in the rain. So let it go where it will flow. Leave all the stars far behind. Thank you.
Michael Martin Murphy's Under a Rolling Sky, and Lisa, I guess you saw plenty of rolling skies while you were doing these long rides. You know, one of the things, yeah, you know, we were talking, we're just going to have to do another show. There are just too many things that we can talk about on this trip, you know. I'm thinking about weather when I'm listening to that song, you know. You surely had encountered a variety of weather. It doesn't just stop raining for you when you're out on the, doing a long ride, and maybe some cold weather and some different things that you encountered. But, and I want to save that for another show. But what I'd like to ask you now is to, if someone is thinking and considering doing a long ride, and by the way, I would expect that that's a pretty small club, isn't it, of people that have actually done 1,000-mile-plus rides?
Well, you can go on the Long Riders Guild website, and it's a surprisingly large group of people, and it's certainly not every day, but and it's more unusual to be solo on it than to be in a group, and it's more unusual to be a woman solo, but
right.
It's definitely not unheard of. Well, as long as I brought that up, you didn't ask about it, but I'm gonna jump right in there. I did get a lot of "it's not safe because you're a woman," and for all those women that want to do this, because as it turns out, it's a surprisingly large number of people that are interested in long riding. Being a woman is not at all a handicap when you're doing one of these. In fact, I would say it's probably an asset, and here's why I say that. If I come riding up to a ranch house and ask if I can camp out in their barn or in their pasture, they're not going to be intimidated by me. And they're probably going to say yes, and they're probably going to invite me in for a shower and dinner. But if a man does the same thing, they might be a little bit nervous about that. So I
right.
think I probably got more hospitality than a man might have because of my gender.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you look at the statistics, you know, one of the people who was advising me described the fist fights that he'd gotten into and all that kind of thing. Well, if you look at the statistics, women don't get involved in violent crimes all that as often as men do. I've never been in a fist fight in my life, let alone on my long ride. I think we kind of figure out how to solve a situation a little bit more delicately than that. Not always. I know women get involved in brawls too, but not as often. And so I think the statistics say that a woman's going to be a little bit safer, and because we get involved in the altercations less often. And so I don't consider being a woman any reason not to take a long ride. There are other reasons that you might not want to take a long ride, but your gender is not one.
Okay. So if I were someone considering doing one of these, what would you say were the considerations outside of not being a reason not to?
It doesn't matter if you're a woman. So the next thing I'm going to ask you about if you're thinking about a long ride is how heavy you're going to be on your horse. And for most people, they really do need to bring a pack animal. You've got to really be willing to go light on the gear and not be too heavy yourself if you're not going to bring a pack horse. So most people need a pack mule or a pack horse. Or one fellow I gave advice to, he rode his mule, and he was overweight on his mule. And when he asked me for advice, he took my advice, but he got himself a pack pony. Okay, that works too.
Right, gotcha.
So if you're not willing to go super, super light on your horse, you're going to need a pack animal. So those are the first two considerations, is watch your weight and your equipment, and don't make your horse suffer. And then the next thing is, you know, really think about your route. One gentleman that I was helping, he's from Texas. He's a retired police officer from Texas. He was going to go charging off through the desert, and he didn't really have a plan for water. And so I asked him, you know, have you mapped out where your water holes are and how you're going to deal with that? And he said, well, I thought I'd stay along the highway, and I'd put up a cardboard sign that said water and have the trucker stop and give me water. And I said, well, that is not going to work. That's the worst idea I've heard in a long time.
Oh, gosh.
So you gotta think through your obstacles. You know, you were asking about terrain and weather and all that. You gotta think through all of that and how you're gonna deal with that, because definitely those can be life threatening to you and your horse. The gentleman with the pack pony, riding the mule and the pack pony, he was going really slowly. He was going about 7 miles a day. So, and he kept calling me as he went from east to west, and he kept calling me as he came across to ask me more questions. And he was doing fine until he got to the desert area. And I told him, now you're going to have to pick up and do more than 7 miles to get to water.
Right.
Well, he did it his way. He got himself a little Amish cart, and he put the water in the cart, and he still did 7 miles a day. but he carried the water with him.
Oh, great.
So there's more than one way to skin a cat, but, you know, you got to think about those things. And a lot of people like to ride their horses barefoot. Well, if you're doing 20 miles a day, you cannot ride your horse barefoot. You're going to have shoes on. In fact, I had to have a couple of sets with Boreum on them, because you really start wearing out your shoes. Well, the same gentleman with the mule, he didn't want to do the steel shoes. So what he did was he got himself a set of Mac boots, and he took them off if the terrain was really easy. You know, remember, he was only doing 7 miles a day. So if he was on easy terrain, he would take them off a few days, because you can't really wear those Mac boots every day. You'll start wearing things. But he would take them off when he could. And, of course, those Mac boots will wear out. But the trucks do lose their mud flaps. So with a knife and duct tape, he could repair it. And he came across with one set of Mac boots.
Oh, wow. So really, you know, it's really just a lot of homework, a lot of preparation in advance to know where you're going to be going and where you're staying. And then, you know, in the case of you, your parents knew the route that you were taking. So let people know, you know, where you're going to be. You and I talked about this the other day, I encouraged you to get a smartphone so you could keep up.
Well, now keep in mind, when I did that first trip on Kacha, they hadn't been invented yet. So
that was then, and this is now. So, you know, things have changed. Coverage areas are larger than they used to be, and we want to be able to keep up with you. Hey, I want to, and we're starting to run low on time, short on time today. You got a couple of books that you wrote. One was The Mustang Journal. The other was that Chasing the California Dream. Was that the name of the book?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And
yeah, my publisher didn't like that title, but I liked it, because remember the fellow that took the ride in 1911, his name was Joseph Smeaton Chase. So I put a little bit of Chase in my title there, Chasing the California
Chasing
Dream.
Chasing the California Dream, that's cute. Now, can those books still be found? Can you get those through Amazon, or how could somebody get
those books? Are available on Amazon. Amazon is down to the last book of the last box of Mustang Journal, but they do still have some, and they have some used available. So people have read it and are ready to pass it along. So they are still available on Amazon.
Okay, and I know that you're starting to plan another long ride. I think you said on the Spanish Trail, following the Spanish Trail. And when do you plan on making that ride?
That one's not till 2020, but I've got a lot of historical research I got to do between now and then, because that trail, you know, it's not as well known as the Santa Fe Trail and the Kearney Trail, but I have found there's a marvelous historical society that has done a lot of work on that trail. So I got a lot of diaries and books to read and maps to pore over before I actually hit the trail on that one.
All right. Well, you know, maybe I'll still be around when you've done that ride, and we can do another show on that. But we do want to have you come back again and visit with us, because, again, there's so much more to talk about with your experiences and the folks that you met and the weather situations and just on and on. So you have been a great guest, and I appreciate very much you taking the time to be with us today on Equestrian Legacy Radio. And so look forward to having you again.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Gary.
All right. Talk with you soon, Lisa. Thanks very much.
All righty.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've just had a great show today. Enjoyed having Pauline Reese on and talking with her. And Lisa Wood was a fascinating guest, and we've certainly enjoyed having her join us today on the show. We remind you that Equestrian Legacy Radio is heard live every Thursday at noon. And also, you can go back and listen to our programs on our podcast, and that's available immediately after the shows. So those you can find on equestrianlegacy.net, and we encourage you to do that. We've had some great guests, and I think you'll enjoy listening to some of our past shows as well. Next week, we start February, and we have Alan Hill with Backcountry Horsemen of America that will be joining us, and Gary Roller will be our guest as well. Gary has been a member of Michael Martin Murphy's band for about 25 years, but Gary is one of the premier Western artists and sculptors. And so we'll be visiting with Gary and talking with him about both his music and his art. So a great show that we have lined up for next February, for the first week in February. So thanks for listening to Equestrian Legacy Radio today. We remind you, if you climb in the saddle, get ready for the ride. Thanks for listening.
There came an early snow. There's been a hoot owl.